we're looking for artifacts, we'll take anything. And you will get every penny and everything, because what happens? We'll walk in with all the items.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we will get started again. I hope that you are finding this useful. Admittedly, it is general because it was designed to be for volunteers, and I noticed looking around the room, we have a number of professionals here that probably could do as good, if not better job than I. But next spring, we will have one that will really be very technical, and that's I encourage you to attend. I just had a question asked to me, and I decided I'd explain it to everyone. On the Mylar, she was asking, wanting to look at it and get some questions. We recommend you get the 3 mil Mylar. And it comes in a variety of shapes. You can buy it by the roll, different widths, different lengths. You can get 50 yards, 25 yards, whatever. You can buy it by the individual sheet. And it's, of course, obviously far more expensive to buy it by the individual sheet. It comes 5x7, 8x11, which is, looks like, I'm not even sure, 17, 14 inches long. What I would suggest you do, if you're interested in Mylar, is to go together as a group. We have several organizations here. Buy it by the roll. Get 50 yards of it. It's going to cost you, I have to look it up, let's say $50 to get a 50-yard roll, 1 yard wide. But then you could share it. You can split the cost. You may only need 10 sheets. Someone else needs 30 feet of it. But then you can cut it up in the sizes and shapes that you want. And you are always going to run across something that you want to encapsulate that doesn't fit this size, or an 8x11, it needs to be 10x6.5 or 10x23, whatever. If you've got the long roll, you can cut it to the shapes that you want, and you can make it oval or triangular or whatever, and save a lot of money. And too often, whether it's buying the acid-free tissue paper, the acid-free boxes or file folders, those things are expensive. And you may only need 10. Well, yes, they'll be happy to sell you 10. But they may charge you 30 cents a piece. If you buy 100, they're only charging, let's say, 20 cents a piece. So the obvious thing to do is to go together as a group. We've got Waseca, Fillmore, and Moore County here today. If the three of you went together, pooled your resources, and ordered the things and then split them up. You only need 10 and you've ordered 30. You get the price break and everyone is happy. And let me just look it up here and see if I can give you a quick example here. You know, obviously, of course, when you want something in a hurry, you can't find it. It's a handy dandy catalog, but not always that usable. Ultraviolet shield for your fluorescent lamps. Come in 48-foot lengths. If you want to buy them individually, you only need two. They're $6 a piece. If you buy 12, you can get 12 of them for $48. In other words, $4 a piece. Well, if you pooled your efforts, wouldn't you rather pay $4 and get the three you want than paying $18? And Fillmore County, I know, probably needs, they could use 1,000 acid-free file folders and boxes to store all their negatives and photographs in. Moore County, they don't have any collection of photographs. They only need 2 boxes. Waseca needs 4 boxes. They have a few more, I'm exaggerating. But by pooling your resources, you can get the best possible price. In southeastern Minnesota, there are a lot of museums. We're just naming some outside. You've got Rushford, Peterson, Caledonia, Spring Valley, Preston, Chatfield, Austin, Albert Lee, Rochester, Winona. That's just a few. If you were all pool your resources and go after these things, you can save yourself a lot of money. And I strongly suggest that you do that. I sent away, and it was my hope to get one of these catalogs for each of you. They're probably being delivered today. That does a fat lot of good when we're here now. So I only have one. I will be leaving this, and what I would ask you to do is share it, whoever gets it first, whether it's Waseca, Fillmore, or Moore County. After you've looked through it, mail it on to one of the other people if they don't have one, so that they can look through it too, and maybe save yourself some money. A couple of little things. I've put catalogs out here from the American Association of State and Local History. Also their handy-dandy little membership form. I would strongly suggest, if your organization doesn't belong, that you join. It would cost you $40 a year to belong as an organization. You only need one membership. You get a newsletter that comes filled with information. You get a monthly magazine that comes with articles and ads relating to history, to running a museum, how to interpret a historic house, how to train guides, whatever, technical leaflets. It's well worth getting a membership just for that. But one other reason, I put out this nice catalog, and it lists all these books, slide programs, videotapes, on books that are necessary, needful to have for running a museum. There's a book called Museum Archival Supplies Handbook. It happens to be this book right here. It lists all the various materials and where you can get them, things that you would need in a museum. Oh, here's one on a little thing you can order for removing tape from documents where someone prior to today, and now that you know better, you won't be using, but someone else did. Here's a handy dandy little $4.85 for a 4-ounce bottle of material that will remove tape safely. But then it even goes a bit further. I was just showing Richard, I brought him some soap that he felt he had to have, and I think from working with landscaping plants and trees that he has, he needs to clean his hands up at the end of the day or whatever reason. Anyway, he wanted some special soap. It's called Orpheus. It's the thing to use in a museum. Well, tells here about it, where you can get it. It's $4.80 a pound. And then the nice thing is, just down below that, it tells you how to use it. Use in no greater concentration than 1%. Well dissolved. Wash the artifact 2 or 3 times, rinse 4 times, and away you go. So this is well worth having. Well, now this book, which anyone can get, $22.25, and all the prices are in here. If you're a member of the American Association of State and Local History, you can get the same book for $19.95. You're saving yourself roughly $3. Well, it doesn't take very long. If you buy, and there's any number of books that you should have, this other one I mentioned, somewhat outdated in some cases, but still valuable, the Handy Dandy Guide to Care of Antiques and Historical Collections. That particular book, I just looked that up here a little bit earlier. You could save $3 again buying it as a member. Well, you buy these books, you get your membership back very quickly. If nothing else, I know money is precious. I'm a state representative for this organization, and they'd take it away from me. I wish they would. But they might take it away from me if they heard me tell you this. But if you can't afford individually as an organization to become a member, then the three of you, the three major groups that are here, pool your money. 40 divided by 3 is 11, 13, roughly $14 a piece. Each pay $14, get one membership, share the magazine. When it comes time to place your orders, whoever is the lucky one to be the handler of it can order the books, get the discount, and you can all benefit. I obviously would want you to get each one of you to have your own, but one being used by all is better than none of you having it. And I know some of you do belong, but keep that in mind. Wherever possible, pool your talents, pool your money. It can go a lot further. That brings up one other item. This has nothing to do with conservation, but we were talking about it outside. While we were talking about conservation, I do just want to mention this to you. I get around the state and I visit, try to visit all of the museums every year. Obviously with 300, it's a little difficult to make all of them. There aren't that many working days, but I do try. In this area, I just listed off roughly 10 museums that are all competing for the same visitors. You all have artifact collections, and yes, there are some differences, but generally how people lived in Moore County 100 years ago is not that much different from how they lived in Fillmore or Houston or Winona or Olmsted or wherever. What I'm suggesting is go around, visit these other museums so you become familiar with them. And then work out a plan among yourselves where you don't have to duplicate each other. We don't need a Pioneer living room in every single museum. If I'm driving through on Old Highway 16, I am not going to pull off the road in Preston, Spring Valley, Austin, Albert Lea, and every other point west because, hey, they've got a Pioneer living room and I do need to see another one. One is enough every 50 or 100 miles. That doesn't mean you can't have some of the same artifacts, but working together, one of you, and of course you get into the argument who gets to be the one that has the bedroom, but then someone else can have the living room, someone else the bathroom, whatever. Create a reason to stop at all of the places. People aren't going to if they know they're just going to see more of the same, but if they can see something different. This doesn't mean you totally don't show something. We're talking about cameras. That doesn't mean, let's say, if Lanesboro, who has a large collection of photographs and camera equipment, were to have an exhibit, that you couldn't have some shown. But just show a few. This will free up some space for you to tell something else. Someone comes into your museum and you see they're really interested in cameras. You say, well, now, if you want to see a larger collection, you go to Lanesboro. Lanesboro may have someone come in that loves pickle jars. That happens to be Waseca's specialty. They could show them a few and say, now, if you really want to see more, then you're going to have to drive up to Waseca, which is not that far away. They've got everything you've ever wanted to know about pickle jars or whatever it might be. Get this round robin. Wherever you stop, you learn about other museums and their collections so that there's a reason to stop everywhere. And yet, if you can only stop at one, you do get kind of a broad base of everything. You see one or two cameras, not 100. You see three pickle jars, but not 4,000, whatever it might be. So think of that. If we could work together, I think it'll make it easier for us, free up display areas, because you won't have to show everything. And we'll have a lot happier group of visitors, because there will be a reason to keep coming around and going to all of the museums, not just going to one. And then there are a lot of people that come in at Dresbach, stop at one museum, and then zoom across the state to South Dakota all I've seen is one, and there's a whole row of excellent museums along I-90 on either side of the road. Brings up one other point. See, one of the problems you have when you have me speaking is that, one, I don't shut up, and two, we cover a variety of things, not always necessarily what we're there for. But 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, the State Society, in cooperation with the Highway Department, started a new program. It's a program that the idea came up in 1970. It took us 17 years to bring it to fruition. But what we are doing is that in highway rest areas along the interstates, there will be historic markers placed with some, each one with a theme relating to the area, some aspect of history. If we'd done it in 1970, we would have been the first in the country. We waited until 87 because we couldn't figure out who wanted to pay for this. Everyone liked it, no one wanted to pay for it. Obviously, Wisconsin, Iowa, North and South Dakota, everyone else in the world has already done it, but we've got our first one went up in Elbert Lee. If you're coming up I-35 out of Iowa, stop at the Information Center, and there is a historic marker. One side it says, Welcome to Minnesota, gives a little blurb about Minnesota, land of giants, mentions Prairie Home Companion, Paul Bunyan, 10,000 Lakes, things like that. Other side has a theme of Minnesota roads, and it talks about a very brief 200-word history of the development of roads in Minnesota. The reason for doing it there, I-35, which is old US 65, originally was Constitutional Highway Number 1, the first major highway in Minnesota. What better spot to talk about highways? You stop at Beaver Creek in South Dakota, but it's our rest area. Welcome to Minnesota, and the plaque there talks about Sioux Quartzsite and Pipestone. Dresbach, which now has one, Welcome to Minnesota, and on the other side is the fashionable tour. The fact that in the 1840s and 50s, the place to go if you were rich and famous was not Monte Carlo. You left New York, you left Boston, you left Philadelphia, and you came to Minnesota to take the steamboat from La Crosse up to St. Paul to Fort Snelling. We'll talk about that. Moorhead, again, Welcome to Minnesota, and on the other side, Bonanza Farming in the Red River Valley. Duluth will get theirs next week, and it talks about Minnesota's seaport. Duluth is our seaport, the only one. Each information center, and there are eight, we'll have a marker. One side, Welcome to Minnesota, because we're welcoming the visitor. The other side, a theme. The rest of them, eventually over the years, will each get one. And there, it'll be, again, a theme, but the same thing repeated on both sides of the sign. So somewhere between here and Winona, on one side or the other, there will be one that will talk about medicine in Minnesota. Obviously close to Rochester, we'll mention the Mayo Clinic, all the other medical things that are significant. Near Sauk Rapids, Sauk Center in Minnesota, there's a rest area. We'll talk about Minnesota authors. Sauk Center was the home of Sinclair Lewis. And we'll also mention other famous authors. Each one will have a different theme. So if you stop, you can learn a little bit about Minnesota. And then we are going to work with the rest area people. Provide them with a sheet so that if someone does come in and say, well, gee, I'm really interested in Minnesota canneries, that they will be able to give them a few facts and figures. First one was 1849, there are 500 of them. We can 39 billion cans of sweet corn each year, whatever it might be, worms and assorted other things. They do can worms, you know, cream style corn. I worked for Libby's for a number of years. Goes right through. Extra protein, it's all clean and safe to eat, but they are in there. I don't eat cream-style corn. Anyway, there will be a sheet telling some facts and figures, a listing of books. If you're really the thing you've always wanted to know about was canneries, they'll be able to tell you that here are three or four books that would give you more information. And then, wherever possible, if there's a museum, close by, or for that matter, anywhere in the state that has an exhibit or specializes in that particular topic, it'll be noted. So if you are interested in canneries, you would be told that as of last Sunday, the Le Sueur City Historical Society in Le Sueur County has an exhibit on the Green Giant Canning Company, only one in the state, that museum that has something on the canning industry. So as you're traveling around, start looking in these rest areas. If you stop there, don't just stop with the usual thing. Get out and look at the marker. Eventually we'll have them all. Interesting note is that on canneries, when we were doing the research for that, we called all over. I mean all over. We called every cannery, canning company in the state. We called economic development. Yes, there are a lot of canneries. There were many. We can a lot of things, everything from carp to succotash. It brings in $15 billion a year, but nobody could tell us what was the first cannery to start, what was the first thing that was canned. That has never been reported. It's really an unknown field, so we're going to have to do some work on that. But there are a lot of things we take for granted. An interesting thing along with that, as you see, I digress here. Do you realize that during World War II, we brought prisoners of war into Minnesota and used them in the canning factories? Our young men were over fighting. We still had to have food, so we had prisoner of war camps. Now, most people don't know we had them. We had Germans and Japanese prisoner of war camps. They're all gone. Most people don't know they exist, and yet they were a very important aspect of our economy at that time. In most cases, they didn't even have to be guarded. I know with German prisoners of war in New Ulm, Owatonna, other places, they were so happy to be here that the last thing they ever thought of was running away. They weren't going to run away to escape to go back to Germany to fight. They were very happy and settled. And let me give you just one more example, and I think this is the saddest thing that's ever happened. Steel County, and I'll mention them by name because I think this is a shame. Usually I don't like to use names, but they had a prisoner of war camp about a mile north of town. I drove by there, rode by there with my father in 1944. I can remember it, a long time ago. I was very small. And I asked my father, what are all those men, all dressed the same, sitting, leaning up against a building, hanging on the fence, what are they? And he said, well, those are German POWs. About 6 years later, 4 years later, drove by again, riding with my father and mother, and here were men, leaning up against the fence, women and children, all looking pretty much the same in clothing. And I said, what are they? Oh, those are displaced persons from Latvia and Lithuania that came in fleeing the Russians, communism, and they were there for a while. A few years later, I drove by, very young, I got my license at 15, drove by, and there were more men, women, and children leaning up against the fence, the buildings, whatever, and they were all Mexicans. Oh, I realized by then, I didn't have to ask, migrant workers brought in to work in the canning factories. The buildings are all gone now. There's just the grove of trees. One of the first things I did when I got this job was rush down to Owatonna, to the county society, and I said, I want to know more about the POW camp just up the road. I'd like to see some pictures. How many people were there? What POW camp? Well, the one where the displaced persons were, where the migrant workers were. Where was that? Mile north of Denver. I've lived here all my life. I never heard of it. And that had, for whatever reason, and maybe I haven't talked to the right people yet, but I've been talking to the county society. They are getting better. They're researching it, and some do know something. But that's just like it's been blocked out of their memory, and whether they're ashamed of having all those people there or what. And yet, it's very important, very interesting. A lot of the people stayed and settled there, become part of their heritage, and yet there's no mention. So there's a lot of work to be to to be done out there yet. Well, anyway, to get back on to what we are here for, I've got, hopefully enough, I'm going to pass this out. This is just a check sheet that tells you the proper temperature and humidity to maintain, if you can, do the best you can, to properly preserve things, everything from microfilm to paper to fur coats, if you have. So if you would take one and pass it along and make sure that Waseca, Lanesboro, Preston, and Austin, each of those groups, each gets one, and I'm sorry I can't give one to every single person. I only have 20 copies, and we have more than 20 people here. Another handout that I'm going to give you to read through on your own time, this talks about, first part is measuring and marking of objects. Part of being a good conservator, good preserver of history, is that every item that comes in is cataloged and marked. This is not often done. Many times the items are there, but they're not marked, and they lose track of who it came from, why, or when. This talks about marking the objects. It also talks about where you put the little identification number on. For instance, such as a gun, you would put the catalog number inside the trigger guard. You can always find it, but it isn't out there for the visitor to see who comes up and says, well, now why does that gun have the number 87.41114? That's for your use, not for the general public. That's contained in here for every item from glass to how to properly catalog the gourd, or if you happen to have, lace, here's my favorite thing, what to do with lace, manuscripts, minerals, masks, you name it, it's here. Then the second part is a handy-dandy little guide, very condensed, very basic, but proper store and care of objects. And again, it takes the same list. How do you store a gourd, or a basket, or a piece of lace, or a skeleton, or a mask, or a piece of metal? It tells you how it should be stored. Again, the proper temperature. If you've got a lot of insects, you don't put them in a sealed bag. They're already dead, so you don't have to worry about them crawling out. You use unsealed plastic bags. I'll pass these around, and again, make sure that everyone, each group, gets one. Starts off with the first page is just a nice little checklist of handling of paper objects. And I'm going to read through this. It isn't that long. Just do this very quickly. It starts off with, in general, one, when handling paper objects, try to handle as little as possible. Two, have clean hands. Or, wear gloves. Three, use a specific work area cleared of other materials. It's easier for paper objects. So easy for paper objects to get mixed up with other things, and while I'm throwing away this junk, I just threw away the original copy of the Constitution because I was in a hurry and forgot that it was there. Also, a key thing too, when working with any artifacts, whether it's paper, glass, lace, whatever it might be, dress properly. Don't come wearing watches and bracelets and beautiful necklaces and long dangling earrings. And it may look very nice, and I know everyone wants to look nice, but it's too easy when you're working with these delicate things to, here's this, again, my favorite piece of lace. This actually isn't lace, but that could get hooked on my bracelet that my wife gave me. I promised I'd never take off, and I haven't in 10 years. Could get hooked on there very easily and torn. And then what? We've got a torn piece of lace. So obviously you have to wear clothes, but the minimal, and leave off the jewelry and all the other things. so that you don't harm the objects you're working with. The next section is called the environment. One, avoid strong light, either from bulbs or natural sunlight, to prevent brittleness or fade. Now, just the fact that there is no strong light or sunlight on an item doesn't mean that it isn't eventually going to get brittle or fade, but at least not as fast. Two, do not leave in an open area. Provide protection from dust, dirt, gusts of air, either by keeping paper objects framed, covered lightly with Mylar, or stored in print boxes. I mean, if this is if these were the words handed down from on high and are meant to be preserved forever, piling them out there like that is not the way to do it. And yet you walk into a museum and you see, and you look at my desk, you look at almost anybody's desk in a museum, and here are a lot of precious things, all just kind of piled around. Well, look at this mess that's sitting here. Some of these things, again, this piece of lace, very precious. That's not the way to be handling it. Three, maintain a temperature of not more than 70 degrees or a relative humidity of 50%. Not always possible to do, but try. In the wintertime, when you're heating your museum, unless you have humidity control, adding moisture into the air, it can get very dry. That dryness is hard on furniture, on paper, it's hard on everything. Now, the least you could do is bring in a humidifier and add a little bit of moisture to the air. You may not be able to maintain 50, but it would certainly be better to have 40 or 35 than 10 or 15, which it could drop down to during the very cold months. Physical hazards. One, do not use staples, tape, glue, dry mounting material, or similar products on or around paper. This is recommending you don't have it at all. Two, do not have food or beverage in the area. Now, I'm famous in work. I always, unfortunately, have a cup of coffee with me. I go through about 15 cups a day. All right, it's sitting on the junk pile I call a desk. Very easy when you're reaching for the phone, trying to find something in a rush that's buried at the bottom of the pile. And there you spilled something. And coffee really stains. So does pop. So don't have stuff around if you've got things out you don't want damaged. Keep away from direct contact with acidic surfaces. Cardboard. The cheapest thing that you can get. We use it for many kinds of things. Here's cardboard. Very high acid count in this paper. They have to use sulfur to make paper, cardboard. This stuff is deteriorating. These precious papers that I want to store, so I put them in this box so they're preserved forever, I'm just helping them deteriorate because I put them into a box that's adding more acid to what's already in the paper. Set things only on a clean, dry surface. Now, all of these are just good common sense things that takes no expert to do, but we just forget about it too often. And in the rush, because there's always too much to do and too few, we do things that we know better, but so we have to start trying. It's like one person was mentioning to me today. A professional has been at this for a long time and knows probably, I'm sure, more than I do. And I was asking her, I said, well, hopefully you're learning something from this today or finding it worthwhile. And she said, well, yes, I knew a lot of the things, but I'd never thought of gloves. And that can make all the difference in the world, just that little thing. There's another sheet here I'd like to read with to you, and you'll have it to take home so you can memorize it. Historic costumes. They're irreplaceable. They must be handled with great care and caution. One, regard all historic costumes as fragile. Whether it looks like it or not, all items have become weakened due to normal wear and long exposure to harmful elements of the environment. So that wedding dress that we're stapling to the wall may look in perfect condition, but it isn't. And we do this not even just with minor things. I had a call recently on a house. People were preserving a house, and they asked us to come down and look at it and tell them what they needed to do to preserve it. So we went through the house, and we told them a huge long list of things, everything from fixing the foundation. The floor joists were rotted away. They weren't termites, but another powder post beetles. And you could take a pencil and jam in the floor beams that were holding up the building. You could jam a pencil in about 2 inches, just pushing it in. That is not built, or not going to last very long before that place will collapse, especially if you're running 40 or 50 people through a place. Or you go into the upstairs and the floor, and if you laid a ball down, it would just roll right into the center of the room. And this group, society, were running school tours of 40 or 50 people into that room at any one time. And very easily could have the situation you probably saw on TV just over the weekend. Some people out on a porch in the cities, and the porch collapsed, and a number were seriously injured. Well, anyway, we gave this list of things they could do, tried to keep it reasonable, inexpensive, and about half of the board who was there, we were talking to the board of directors, well, I don't see why we have to do that. The house looks good. It stood here for 120 years. Surely it'll stand for another 100. Well, it might stand for another 100, maybe. The site is on the National Register. It's deemed one of the valuable things in the state. We want to be more than just guessing at whether it's going to be around 100 years. That house was not built to be running groups of 40 and 50 people through at a time. A house is built for a family. Once in a while you get a number of people in, but generally it's a handful. When you start putting 40 people into the center of a room where the floor is sloping, that's putting a lot of weight. That whole floor could collapse, and nothing wrong. I walked into the center of the room. Now, granted, I'm heavier than most people, but I walked into the center of the room alone and went like that, and pictures were shaking on the wall. Furniture was moving. Nothing wrong with that building. Well, just because it may look good doesn't mean that it's necessarily in good shape. Do handle costume items as infrequently as possible. I mean, if this were valuable, I've handled this far more times this morning than it should be handled in 4 or 5 years if we want to save it. Under no circumstances should anyone wear historic costumes. So if you're going to have a style show, get items that are donated just for that purpose, be used, not the invaluable items from your collection. It'd be nice to show them off. At least you can take a picture and show them the photograph, but don't put on the 200-year-old wedding dress to show how nice it looks, and then it gets a tear or falls apart, and then you have nothing other than, well, she certainly did look nice in it when she was wearing it for those 5 minutes. 3, do avoid folding costume items. Folding accelerates the breaking of already weakened fibers. Cushion necessary folds with acid-free tissue paper. If you have to fold something, it should be laid flat. But if you have to fold it, cushion the folds so that you're not just getting the beautiful crease. That isn't the way to do it. Make it more a rounded fold. Do have clean hands when handling costume items. Use the gloves. Protects the garments from body oils as well as dirt on the surface of the hands. Now, here's an important thing which could be easily overlooked. The gloves, however, must be kept clean. I mean, don't buy one pair of gloves and use them for the next 29 years. Change them often, clean them, or as I would recommend, and it's not that expensive to use the throwaway, buy these, use them for one day, or one afternoon, or one project, and then throw up. Don't take the chance. The things we're trying to save are too precious to hope that we haven't done more damage already. Do fully support all costume items when moving or transporting them from one area to another. Support costumes when they're on display. Don't just take the dress, the jacket, the whatever it is, the bloomers that you're showing, and hang up on the wall. Even if you're hanging them properly with a padded hanger or whatever it might be, not stapled, don't just let them hang there forever. That isn't doing them any good either. I mean, you've helped it by putting them on a padded hanger, but do the proper things to support it so that there isn't weight being put on some seam. Even new clothes you can buy and put on and move wrong or bend wrong, whatever, and suddenly there's a horrible noise and a seam is gone, or at least you hope that's all that's gone. And you can imagine what can happen with older items. The thread is even less strong. Do carefully pack your materials away, and when you're packing things away, make sure you're not packing unwanted things away. Very easy. You might be doing all kinds of good conservation things and boxing things up in acid-free tissue paper, putting them away in the proper storage, but make sure that a little bug didn't sneak in that you packed away there to do its thing while you think, we're safe, I did all the right things. Which leads into, very nicely, this wasn't planned, the environment can be a source of danger. One, do inspect costume items for insects. If anything is discovered, isolate the item from the rest of the collection in a sealed container until action can be taken. I've seen items brought into a museum, accepted, oh, wonderful, thank you for bringing this, put on display, and they were infected. I mean, if you happen to lift it up and look underneath, all kinds of little things crawling around. And they spread. They don't just stay on that one item, they get into the other item. And then it goes on to list a number of things you can do to kind of get rid of some of these bugs by, say you have a small item that may or may not have some creatures in it. Stick it in your freezer for a little while. Carefully wrapped, of course. Watching out for freezer burn, which can happen to clothing too in a freezer, just like to meat. But you can freeze those little devils and not have to worry about them again. Another thing that would be worth doing in almost any museum is periodically, and most museums close down for the winter or for moving, whatever purposes, call Orkin. They can come in an unmarked car. That's what they advertise anyway, so the neighbors don't have to know. But get a fumigator out and fumigate the whole building. If there's something in there, that doesn't mean something else might not come crawling, flying, carried in at some time. But at least you can get rid of the ones that are there. Doesn't take that long, doesn't cost that much, and you can be sure that your items are going to be safer than they were. Watch out for fluctuations in temperature and humidity. This is very hard on fibers and everything else. You get expansion, contraction. Why is it? Let's see, we'll pick somebody here, you, who are going to, in a few months, close up your house and go to Florida for the winter to escape Minnesota's cold. And when you do, I hope that it's just like this year and it's colder there than it ever was up here this past winter. But you've gone south for the winter, Texas, Florida, wherever. Now, you would never think of leaving your home unheated. You turn the heat down to 45, but you keep the house heated because, hey, you know, we've got valuable things in there. Furniture, it isn't good for them. Same people that will do that think nothing of, well, it's wintertime, the museum is closing up, they turn off the heat, lock the door, go away for 6 months, and there the artifacts sit. 30 below one day, 30 above the next, 90 before the museum opens in the spring. That's all right, but you wouldn't do it with your own things. Well, it's not all right. Treat those items in the museum like you would your own home. If you won't turn off the heat in your home, then you don't turn it off in the museum either. If you have to, because you can't heat the building, there's no insulation, we don't have a furnace, we can't afford the heat, then take your precious items out of there And while I don't encourage moving the things around, I would rather see them moved and put in somebody's basement where they could be given some stable conditions than to sit in an unheated building fluctuating from one end to the other. This often happens, another example of this, and this applies to almost any county society, they always have something on the fairgrounds. They have a building that's been given to them, and in that they have, oh, there's farm machinery and all kinds of things. Once a year, that building is open for the fair, the 3 days, the week, depending upon how big a fair. Nothing is ever thought of that building until about the fair's coming up next week, we gotta get a crew out, go out, open up the doors, clean it out. For a week, there are people running around, and then, well, lock the door, make sure all the windows are shut, and it's back to the museum, and we can forget about that. Well, those poor artifacts are certainly not getting the proper care. I mean, if they're worth saving, if they're worth preserving, they need a little more thought than once a year when, well, we got to get ready for the fair again. Again, this goes on, keep your work areas as clean as possible. In the process of cleaning things, don't get them dirtier than they were before you started. Very seldom should you ever wash clothing. It is not recommended. Usually you will do more harm than good. Yeah. Dust things, brush them off, but generally if you have old textiles, old clothing, don't, well, we'll do the good thing and we'll wash it up. You can be doing more harm than good by washing and cleaning. Running a vacuum cleaner over just to take off the dust is one of the best things you can do. Very simple to do. Now, you don't take your Hoover that can pick up a piece of dust from 50 feet away and suck it into the container. Preferably use a battery-operated, one of the little hand-operated ones that you use in your car. Not much suction to it, but enough. Use that. Then that's what you actually use this for. This is not lace. This is a Mylar screen. And the idea behind this, you can use the little sewing hoop or just take it like this. You lay it over the item. Then you run your vacuum cleaner over that. And the reason for this, it'll allow the dust to come through, but you're not going to suck the clothing right up into the vacuum cleaner, the little thread that you pull out of it, and suddenly that little thread that was only so long here is suddenly yay long. You've got to, again, just common sense. You lay this over the item, run your vacuum cleaner over. You aren't going to worry about pulling buttons off. How many of you had to fish into the, did that on a piece of furniture? Leather, has nice little leather buttons, had to go through the vacuum cleaner bag and find one that went through the cleaner. Wasn't an old artifact, so it wasn't that important. But if it were, you know, you might not always be able to find it. Or your a beaded dress. Now, there are some of those around. Very hard to clean. The least you can do is dust them off, use the vacuum cleaner again. But again, you don't want to suck up all those beads in the vacuum. You lay this over it. Get the dust, but not the beads. This goes on with basic steps in caring for various items in the museum. This also contains the sample schedule lists of what to do for planning spring and fall openings and closing of the museums, like scheduling what should be done daily as far as cleaning. Weekly, monthly, quarterly, semi-annually, yearly, every other year. Also lists some of the equipment that you can use, what type of bags, what type of brushes, what type of gloves. And I'll pass this around. Let's see, you always keep starting with this table, so let's start over here with this batch. And read through that as you get time. I think you'll find it very helpful and usable. Now, I promised Dick that I said when I came I would have lots of handouts. I think you will agree that by the time you go home you're going to have a handful. This next one I'm going to give you is an archival supply handbook. It's done by our archives department. It talks about such things as acid-free boxes, shows the different types that are available, talks about storage of microfilm. Microfilm is a wonderful thing. We say, you know, it's the greatest thing ever, because rather than having the bound volumes of the newspapers that pile up and up and up and are deteriorating and are hard to use, you use microfilm, takes less space, whatever. Microfilm needs to be taken care of properly, too. This talks about that in here, gives you a list of some other reading material that you may want to get from the library or send away for to get. So I'll start that down the line for you. Now, near and dear to the hearts of some of you here, this little handout is one called The Approach to the Care of Photographs. Talks about how to handle them, enemies of photographs, how to properly mount them, how to properly store them. Little things like put your original copies of photos in acid-free file folders, sort them by size. Don't put an 11 by 17, an 8 by 11, a 3 by 5, a 4 by 5, a 5 by 7, all in the same file. Sort like sizes together so that when you've got the file folder, and we're always in a rush, and we'll pretend this is a file folder. I've got some pictures in here already. I pulled one out that I'm using, and comes time to put it back. It happens to be 8.5 by 11. What's in there is a 3 by 5. I'm in a rush, so I quickly open it up, jam it in, not quite that hard, but in a hurry, I push it. You may just bend the photographs that are already in that file folder, trying to put another one away to preserve it. You can lessen that if it's always the same size, 8.5 by 11 with 8.5 by 11, 3 by 5s with 3 by 5. Again, with photographs, remember you don't use the bare hands to pick them up. You use gloves. Another thing, this gets into the collecting of again. When you get photographs, and we all collect them, make sure you document them. Every photograph that comes in, on the back, using a pencil, number 2, soft lead, not a pen or a felt tip, which can bleed through. Upper right hand, left hand, whatever corner, but one corner, write in who, well, answer the questions who, what, where, when, why, and how. Who's on the photo? Why was it taken? When was it taken? Where was it taken? I was out Tuesday. People were showing me some pictures that we don't know what to do with. Well, there were many of them, but we'll take one in particular. We don't know what to do with this. We don't know anything about it. I said, what is it? Two young men, nicely dressed, leaning up against a car. They don't know who the young men were, where the picture was taken, whether it was even taken in Minnesota. They don't know why it was taken or where it was taken. The only thing we could figure out, we gave it serious study. The young men were about 22 years old. They were leaning up against a 1938 Ford. So there we know that it was taken after 1938. Couldn't have been taken before. Car was in pretty good shape, so it couldn't have been too many years later. It was undented, unscratched, unrusted. The young man looked of service age. Our best guess was that here were two young men either just getting ready to go off to fight in World War II, or had just come back from fighting in World War II and had, with their accumulated pay that they didn't get a chance to spend in France or wherever they were, had purchased a car. That might have been in Minnesota, might have been in who knows where. Well, they said, what should we do with it? My response was, because that's all that picture was worth. You don't know who it, I mean, two men with a car, there's thousands of photos like that. What you need to know is who the men were, why it was taken, when, where, then it's worth keeping. And make sure, another example I'll use, let's say you have a picture of somebody's house. You have a picture of my home. For whatever reason, you decided you're going to save it. The home of David Nystuen. Which home? My wife and I just celebrated our 23rd anniversary. We have lived in 20 different houses since we were married. Each paying bills. Yes, that's right. Always a new place. We move. We don't have to clean. We don't have to fix. One year, we pack up and move. We throw away a lot of junk. There's a lot of benefit. But which home do you have a picture of? This is the one I was born in, the one I grew up in, the one I died in, the one I became famous in, if I were famous. The first one we lived in when we were married, the last one before the divorce, whatever it might be. We aren't divorced, but that happens quite common. You need to write down which home. This is the home David Nystuen lived in 1979. I mean, if it's important to have that photo and keep it,